So what we're going to be talking about is the whole notion of the swinging 60s. And the very notion of the swinging 60s in itself is quite an interesting phenomenon, which very much is at the root of the histories of journalism for so many things that we've looked at today. We've looked at some of the negative sides over the last few weeks, and we've looked at some of the beginning to be positive sides in terms of art and creativity. If I take you back to the Angry Young Men and the play and movie Billy Liar, at the end of that particular narrative, Billy himself was too scared to leave the working class north of the New Wave. But his girlfriend actually got on the train to London. The 60s, in other words, had clearly arrived, and London was beginning to be seen as the destination to go to, as indeed it was in this particular movie. Turn to that later, particularly with this name here, Mary Quant, as we progress through this particular piece. But not the title girl there, Georgie Girl, but her flatmate, played by Lynn Redgrave, who's actually seen dashing through the streets of London, having made a horrendous decision with respect to a wig and all the fashion that goes with it as well. So let's consider the opening question then. Why was it in particular that in the 1960s things were changing? Things were changing, certainly as far as London was concerned, and arguably Britain, although it probably took other parts of the country considerably longer before they felt anything relating to the scene that was going on in London. Well, I started off with a movie for three deliberate reasons. One, because it actually started opening up the beginnings of a new form of popular cultural fun movie. But it also was a British movie. And the British film industry had primarily been in terminal decline. The notion of this particular perfect storm, as Dominic Sandbrook actually argues, is very much this whole dream culture. We've looked at how America was promoting and exporting its vision of capitalism and consumerism. That if you actually wanted to actually be content and happy with your lot, you would buy material, and you'd go on to buy more material, and so on. We'd also talked about the growth of the teenager and the areas with respect to that whole factory-produced element. And certainly, if you do have disposable income and you're looking for things to do, etc., the arts and the cultural scene is one of those key areas. And we talk about a fusion of both advertising and retail, all connecting with the glamour industries. You know, photography can be very glamorous. The music industry, likewise. We'll look today at how the Beatles were manufactured, developed, worked through the process. Fashion It's always there. We've had the Milan Fashion Week, the Paris Fashion Week, the New York Fashion Week. London very much begins to start centering on that. And obviously the whole notion of art, how that is expressed, how it's considered as art, how it represents the culture, again, very much critical to our understanding of this. There's a particular significance in that title there, because as I said, the British film industry had been in terminal decline. And the New Wave films that we've looked at, Saturday Night and Sunday Morning, Look Back in Anger and so on, they weren't box office successes. Yes, they were influential to a select few of undergraduate intelligent individuals who would go and see them and chatter about them, but they weren't mass popular successes. Primarily because the films were seen as too miserable and too depressing. Why would you want to go to the cinema to see stuff which was too close to the life that you were living at home? But other films were much more successful. These in particular were the first in the vanguard of a new wave of popular cultural movies. Now, these weren't family films, as you can tell. The X certificate is the equivalent to the 18 rating, or at least the 15 brand of today's certification. But the big difference with respect to this was that they were in colour. Ever since the cinema was invented, people have liked horror movies. They've been a very popular part of filmic culture. They tend to emerge in times of social stress. There are lots of studies which show that actually you can tie in problems that society are having with what is being in vogue in terms of the movies at the time and so on. And Hammer Studios had actually gained the rights to remake a series of horror films that had originally been put out in the 1930s under the banner of Universal. Frankenstein, The Wolfman, Dracula, and so on. The big difference, though, were those movies were in black and white. These were colour movies. And these early films, Curse of Frankenstein, Brides of Dracula, gradually, through word of mouth, through popularity, developed a whole range of cult status, to the extent that we still talk about Hammer horror today. The studios regularly bought, rebought, etc. There are various sort of lines where people say that Hammer horror films were part of the functional British industry. Why were they popular? Well, number one, they were escapist. They were sexually very permissive. They were also comprised of stylish fantasies, admittedly set in a gothic environment, but stylish fantasies about people who did what they liked and they weren't much concerned about the larger world events. You could almost say the typical teenager. Dracula does what he does when he wants, at night obviously, because he can't stand the sunshine. Likewise Frankenstein, the whole range of things echoes that whole system. And the protagonists of the movies were primarily out to satisfy their own needs and desires, which arguably fitted in with the outlook of the young at the time. And then, of course, in 1963, we have this particular strike force, the early 60s, 1962, 1963, and so on. Now, Bond had been formed originally in 1953, written by Ian Fleming, the first text being Casino Royale. There had been various attempts to actually have a screen incarnation of Bond. The first ever radio James Bond was a South African actor who became well known as a quiz host in his latter years, Bob Holness. He was the first official Bond. There was an American TV adaptation of James Bond, an adaptation of Casino Royale. And if you want the trivial pursuit answer to the question, the first ever screen James Bond was Barry Nelson. But then there was this notion of Bond in the cinema. Would it work? Would it not work? Very much the ultimate consumerist success story. And together with the Beatles, one of two major cultural products which were the biggest exports that Britain actually had throughout the 60s to the rest of the world. The top earning 1960s films across the generations were James Bond films. And these were, if not totally family movies, certainly movies which were given A certificate, so basically you get the equivalent of our 12A today, so you can actually go and attend them, you could see them as family outings, etc. They comprise a whole range of adventures. Most people have seen at least one James Bond movie in their lifetimes. We'll find out whether that is the case when we talk about this on Thursday. But with Dr. No and From Russia with Love, these were huge successes. They were also British productions, They featured British crews. They even, with obviously the Scotsman Sean Connery, had a British cast leading up the line. They did, on the other hand, rely on American capital, because Britain didn't have the money to plough into the special effects. So the relationship was developed to really get this British-American hybrid. Britain would provide the technicians, and the actors, and stories. America would provide the cash. Start really in many ways of the special relationship in terms of film. America would get the profits, but actually for a brief halcyon moment, Britain was very much at the top of the tree. Even though it couldn't compete with American and indeed European film because it actually lacked any state backing. The government were not interested in actually funding the film industry as such, so there was never any money. Now the Bond films themselves became iconic. They were very much of their time, of their era, and arguably still are. American consumerism, remember, at this time is in full flow. Other cultural events, such as Vietnam, such as the Cold War with the Soviet Union, the space race, and so on, were also in vogue. People were aware that these things were actually happening. But James Bond himself is surely the ultimate male consumer. He wears expensive designer clothes. He jets from exotic location to exotic location, whether it's Jamaica, Istanbul, Las Vegas, Japan, the Bahamas. You're basically sort of raising that whole profile of a global traveller. The plots themselves are spectacular. Bond is promiscuous. The movies are full of glamorous 60s women, and Bond himself drinks martinis and eats gourmet food. So in a culture that's increasingly obsessed with materialism, worldly success and sex, Bond ultimately is that ultimate expression of the consumerist fantasy. And everyone flocked to the cinema. Now Harry Saltzman, who you may recall was one of the producers of Look Back in Anger, before he felt that wasn't making any money at all, and connected with Albert Cubby Broccoli, to effectively develop the Bond series. He also made a series of films based on novels by Len Dayton. They were called The Ypres File. It's from Russia with Love, not Len Dayton. And they also launched the career of a young actor called Michael Caine. Harry Palmer, who was the character portrayed by Caine, was very much the poor man's James Bond, if you like. The Ypres File in 1965, followed by Funeral in Berlin and Billion Dollar Brain, all feel slightly more British. They weren't as kind of globally broad strokes as Bond. Harry Palmer, as I mentioned, was played by Michael Caine. And they did have a surreality to them. They were kind of partially a bit like the Avengers. We showed you an excerpt from that. And they certainly had some typical 1960s psychedelic moments. However, as far as Michael Caine is concerned, that is the film that pretty much launched his career. What's it all about? Alfie. Alfie was filmed in 1966. It was another British film about sex and permissiveness among the young. Alfie's only goal is sex. He can't make relationships, he isn't interested in anything except promiscuity, and in the end he's left with nothing. Now you might argue this is a strange account of a new wave protagonist in a counter-cultural setting, but you are seeing this whole notion of the counterculture here. And the final message of the movie itself, what's it all about, again sort of raises that whole question about you've got money, you've got affluence, but does that actually make you happy? If we actually look at the trailer that comes through from Alfie, maybe we get a little insight into his thoughts.
Get your knee off the steering wheel.
I can't, I'm stuck.
Here, look out, I'll do it.
Oh!
Well, you're settled in. Right, we can begin. My name is...
Alfie.
Alfie, bubbles with impudent humour and ripe modern wit, says the New York Times. I was having a beautiful little life. There was this manageress of a dry cleaner's. And I was getting a suit cleaned in the bargain.
Everybody's running after Alfie.
Do you love me?
And what can I say when you ask? You shouldn't ask, you know. I'll tell you when I feel like it.
Would you like me to give you something to make you sleep?
Now, there's a good idea.
All right, come with me.
Michael Caine gives a brilliant performance, says Red Book magazine. Is Alfie really as good as all that?
Now, what's the ticket about?
Shelley Winters thinks so.
Now, what's your address?
Alfie returns the compliment.
She's in lovely condition.
Condition is everything in life.
I'll just get you ready for your injection, Mr. Elkins.
Oh, thank you, nurse.
The New York Daily News gives Alfie 4 stars and says that people are going to stop talking about Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf and start talking about Alfie.
Oh, what are you so impatient about?
Alfie, a delightful comedy. Direct hit. Presented in the best of humor and with complete frankness, says the New York Post. Michael Caine is superb, says the Saturday Review.
Alfie, you might say, has it name?
Alfie, what's it all about? Alfie, is it just for the moment we live?
As Life magazine puts it, you are going to enjoy Alfie very much.
Indeed, it was also remade with Jude Law in the lead role a few years ago. But it's still, again, arguing that whole notion of it's a representation of a form of Britishness. It's in colour. It's breaking the fourth wall long before Deadpool actually started doing it from the point of view of addressing the audience directly. But it's also a huge success with respect to the critics as well. And most importantly, culturally, it's giving a good reputation, or it's providing another representation of Britain within the world and international stage. So, we're midway through the 60s. Alfie was directed by Lewis Gilbert, who also went on to direct You Only Live Twice. So again, he had Bond credentials with respect to that as a director and so on. Other notable films include Georgie Girl, which we've already seen the first clip from in 1966. The story of Georgie Girl is that a good-looking but shallow 1960s girl, played by Charlotte Rampling, has a promiscuous lifestyle. She has a baby but abandons the child to her plain and plump flatmate, played by Lynn Redgrave, who we saw in the opening credits. The only reason she abandoned the child was so that she can go back to a hedonistic 1960s lifestyle. Accident, another movie scripted by Harold Pinter and starring Dirk Bogart, also echoed this notion of self-centred people who don't take much responsibility for any damage that they actually do. From the European perspective, Blow Up is a wonderful way in which the photographic world of hedonistic lifestyles is really being developed. Not that you'd ever see Stuart Wilde engaging in any such shenanigans and so on, but fundamentally what you actually have here is the notion of the photographer as a cult package of the 1960s. Somebody who's actually producing a whole range of activities and is very much setting the scene for the zeitgeist, the spirit of the time.
Sometimes reality is the strangest fantasy of all. The films of Michelangelo Antonioni speak every language. This is his first in English.
Blow up. So you're setting it in a sequence which is in London, which kind of represents the whole essence of London lifestyle. You even had a very brief shot there of the anti-Vietnamese protesters, which again we've talked about in previous sessions as well. And Blow Up certainly is again echoing that whole essence of how things are kind of coming apart, but at the same time coming together, like a sort of general sort of crazy trip. Blow Up itself actually was based on the life of a real-life fashion photographer who you may have heard of called David Bailey. It was designed to convey the glamorous world of swinging London with beautiful people such as Vanessa Redgrave and Jane Birkin. It had female nudity, it had far-out experiences, it showed people having problems with the sensation-fueled world in which they live in. But, question to be considered, was it a real culture? Or was it just about getting the young to spend money, saying this is the happening thing, this is the one that we all need to go and see, etc., etc. Ultimately, the Americans would actually pull out of the British film industry and move on to various other factors, and the industry would actually all but collapse until it kind of was revitalized by a certain movie in 1977 developed by George Lucas called Star Wars. You might have heard of it. But nevertheless, in the swinging 60s, Britain was very much back at the centre of the cultural map, and it was competing in the wider world. The British fashion industry also began to show signs of life here. As teenagers increasingly consumed, fashion became big business in both America and in Europe. And there were three major British designers of the period. Does anybody know who that one is? Okay, it's Mary Quant. Do you know what Mary Quant effectively was credited with actually helping to popularise? Yes. It was indeed the miniskirt, absolutely. It's not, I mean, again, there's moot point as to did she invent it, did she popularise it? She certainly did. She also developed the whole notion of androgynous, skinny models, particularly twiggy, pinafore dresses, skinny rib sweaters, white collars. The Mary Quant look, as an iconic look, is very identifiable. It's quite clearly marked out as a special period of the time. Likewise, Barbara Hulanicki was a Polish immigrant. She studied design at the Brighton School of Art. We're beginning to see people who've been educated through the art school and college-based system emerging into the scene a few years afterwards and developing a whole range of activities and so on. Hulanicki started selling originally through mail order, and she founded the store Biba, B-I-B-A, in 1964. It was a shop in the High Street, Kensington, and it sold everything. It sold tie-dye T-shirts, it sold feather boas, makeup, velvet trousers. It was a lavish place which attracted the famous and the beautiful people, and it stayed open until 1976. Very popular. Again, part of the place to go and see if you wanted to keep up with fashion and so on. Ozzie Clark was also very successful in the mid-1960s, and his designs also made it in New York. Ozzie Clark, that isn't him, by the way, that's Twiggy, was so successful that he was the first British clothes designer to actually have his clothes make an impact in both Europe and America. Ozzie lived the hedonistic lifestyle to the full. He took drugs, he dressed the rich and famous. His career declined in the 1970s with drug addiction, bankruptcies, comebacks, various other things. Finally, he was stabbed to death by his lover in 1996. A rather unfortunate end for Ozzie Clark. But also John Stephen worked as a fashion designer, originally from Glasgow. He created Carnaby Street. He opened a string of boutiques which catered for the young who were seeking trendy fashions. And Carnaby Street in itself became as famous as King's Road in Chelsea. And obviously, from Stephen's point of view, he made a fortune. Britain was perhaps even better known for exporting the whole brand of music. We've got Gene Shrimpton, we've got Twiggy, they've all connected from that sort of point of view. And then, of course, we get this next young band who've emerged from Liverpool, a northern town. A northern town and a lecture about swinging London. Who'd have thought it? And yet, probably more important than both film and fashion put together was this British merchandising opportunity and success of the 1960s. Four lads from Liverpool, you see them there, the Beatles. Now, by 1963, the Beatles were the preeminent band, as far as youth was concerned, in Britain, bar none. They weren't an overnight success. They'd been developed. They'd been put in suits by Brian Epstein. They'd been created, developed. We look at some of this in an excerpt from the Beatles documentary that Ron Howard put together again on Thursday. But they clearly were a huge success. By 1963's September period, both She Loves You, Please Please Me and Twist and Shout were all in the charts, and they'd all hit number one. In October 63, they were booked to appear on the hugely successful at the time television show Sunday Night at the London Palladium. This was the top-rated ITV variety show. And the event inevitably got front-page coverage, as well as the line by John Lennon, for those of you in the cheap seats, will you clap your hands? Those of you in the posh area, please rattle your jewellery. Again, a sort of quirky nature that comes through that. But what this actually saw then was by September, October 1963, teenage culture had finally made it into the mainstream of British life. It was being accepted by the establishment. The establishment who were comprised of Parliament, the church, the monarchy, and so on. According to the Daily Mirror, 60 police fought to hold back 1,000 screaming fans on the pavement outside the London Palladium. Actually, a picture in the Daily Mail showed there were 3 girls and a policeman. Whatever the truth of the matter, Beatlemania as a phenomenon had been born. By the time they appeared in November at the Royal Variety Command performance, there were thousands of screaming fans, 500 additional police, and the programme was watched by 26 million. Kind of audience you'd probably only get now if England were actually in a World Cup final or semi-final and so on. Now, it's fair to say not everybody admires the Beatles. Many people actually thought that the Beatles themselves represented the ugly face of an affluent consumer-led culture. They had long hair. They had provincial accents. They sounded northern. They were northern. They didn't actually go for received pronunciation, so they sounded like cheeky lads from Liverpool. Brian Epstein, their manager, was perceived as grasping, all about the money, all about the commercialism. And the public appearances of the Beatles, and we'll look more about this on Thursday, the public appearances also reminded people of the Nuremberg rallies. Now remember, this is a period that's just 30 years after Adolf Hitler had risen to a wave of popular power and support on the basis of mass hysteria. And here we were seeing another form of mass hysteria, but over 4 lads from Liverpool, a pop group, and so on. These concerts were comprised of large crowds of hysterical girls, again from one viewpoint, who didn't seem to be able to think for themselves, who would scream mindlessly over the what were seen as dire lyrics. And certainly Love, Love Me Do, Do You Know I Love You, I'll Always Be True, So Please Love Me Do, is not necessarily the most Dickensian or Shakespearean of lines. This is obviously before they go off on a whole range of interesting developments as well. Ultimately, the popularity of the Beatles didn't seem to be about culture. It was about adolescence, it was about hormones, it was about sexual attraction. If we look at the Simon Cowell aspects of contemporary sort of area, the One Directions, the sort of areas of that, there are kind of reflections of that in the same sort of thing, in the sort of notion of it can change your life overnight. Will you actually be on the tour? Will you not be on the tour? And so on. But at the same time, at this particular period, there was lots of money to be made out of this whole new media-driven phenomenon. The young had greater access to money than ever before, and the young would tend to be easy or relatively easy to manipulate. They were seen as easy targets for any phenomenon that was driven by mass advertising and peer pressure. If you didn't like the Beatles, you must like the Rolling Stones. If you didn't like the Rolling Stones, you must like the Who. If you didn't like the Who, you probably like the Shadows, and so on and so forth. There were Beatle wigs, there were models, there were posters, there were bed linens, there were fanzines. Again, critics would argue that culture itself was being replaced largely by a craze for consumption. Gratification wasn't about getting to grips with difficult new music or a new art form or a Stockhausen opera and so on. It wasn't about deepening your own perceptions. It was, as we'd seen in that opening clip from Georgie Girl, culture was about changing your hairstyle. That's culture. Now, there's no doubt that the Beatles sold records. For every person who actually bought a Beatles record, there were 50, though, who didn't. But at the same time, they sold far more records than their competitors, the Rolling Stones, the Yardbirds, the Kinks, and so on. And Capitol Records themselves aggressively marketed the Beatles. As I mentioned, 1963, critical year here. The year of From Russia With Love, the Bond movie. The year of the Beatles. Really seeing some global successes and huge global numbers. And at the end of 1963, when the Beatles had conquered Britain, the only place to go from their perspective was the larger American market. And Beatlemania hit America in February 1964. Again, a really key and significant date. Some 5 months after the American young president, John F. Kennedy, had been assassinated. A little bit less, maybe 4.5 months. So America is in a state of shock. And yet you have this notion here that somehow, on one level, the Beatles come along with their optimism, with their positivity, with their cheekiness and so on, and maybe show that there is actually a future. There are lots of interviews with folk ranging from Whoopi Goldberg onwards to actually sort of say that for them, they didn't actually sort of acknowledge the fact that they were the white lads, that was irrelevant. They effectively were people who kind of energised the whole system. America had always had plenty of its own bands, certainly. Arguably, rock and roll was an American export, and Bill Haley and the Comets were somebody that effectively, together with Elvis Presley, had been very much key to popular music and culture. But this was different. This was a case of the Beatles selling to America what for so many years prior to this had been the reverse. Even going back to Glenn Miller, Bing Crosby, Frank Sinatra, and the sort of pre-Elvis Presley bands. American culture would primarily be the standard in which pop culture, at least, was kind of measured. Here was a case where, quite clearly, not only from the point of view of radio stations, not only from the point of view of concert venues, not only from the point of view of record sales, that actually British youth culture was proving to be very, very much, It was highly marketable in terms of the ways forward, in terms of how it was working. It was a money machine. The Stones and the Yardbirds and the Kinks all effectively travelled off to actually do their bit in America as well, but none of them were really quite as successful as the Beatles. But nevertheless, the Beatles seem to have this magic touch. They seem to open the door to marketing British youth culture abroad. And pretty soon you actually had a reversal of the situation, because obviously if imitation is the sincerest form of flattery, then clearly one of the ways forward as far as the Beatles is concerned is for America to start inventing its own bands and develop their own particular aspects which they can sell back to Britain. The Beach Boys obviously were there from the Surfer Sound. Equally, the Monkees had also developed the whole system. And if you actually contrast the whole area of the Beach Boys and the elements coming through with that with the Monkees, just again consider this opening episode and the opening sort of titles from the Monkees, with, of course, a British lead.
Television, do you?
And if you ever watch the Beatles movie Help, directed by Richard Lester, and then compare it with the Monkees, you'll see huge similarities. And yet the Monkees in themselves also carved open a whole range of elements and developments, whether it was a case of Davy Jones, the British lead singer, Mickey DeLenz, Mike Nesmith, or indeed Peter Tork. Although they were classified as a manufactured band, they still effectively sort of had positive responses to that. Again, in an era where, from their own point of view, yes, they were actually commenting as teenagers, as populists at the time as well. But let's go back to that little question there. Because again, it's worthwhile considering in terms of how things develop with respect to British or American values. And how a colourful series like The Monkees, obviously advent of colour TV, etc., can open up a whole range of other factors. Maybe the kids have got it right and so on. Well, there are two things that you need to take into account if you're addressing this particular aspect. First of all, the gap between high culture and commerce began to disappear in the 1960s. Prior to that, people knew that a Rembrandt or a Picasso or a Constable or a Da Vinci were works of art worthy in their own right. They weren't just throwaway culture. Shakespearean first folio was a kind of clear aspect, Charles Dickens and so on. Artists like Andy Warhol in America and Peter Blake and Richard Hamilton in Britain were also very happy to sell their work commercially rather than wait until they were dead to actually be regarded as working artists and so on. And both Peter Blake and Richard Hamilton created famous album covers. Peter Blake's most famous one probably being the Sgt. Pepper cover, which if you aren't familiar with it, again, look it up on one of the Google sites and so on. With, as we mentioned, David Bailey photographing celebrities for glossy magazines. It's the start very much of the serious paparazzi culture here. Something which kind of built on the back of the success of the Hollywood movie industry, the starring, finding out what our celebrities got up to in their own time and so on. And as far as music was concerned, prior to the 1960s, the gap that was seen between high culture and low culture, between the classical concerts, the string quartets, and the chamber music, and the dancehall music, was probably jazz. Beatles and other bands began to explore that and develop different generic forms. As part of the expansion of education, and this is the second point, high schools and art schools had also developed strongly. The Arts Council itself had actually set about promoting new, young, contemporary artists, the sort of people who would study in art schools. They didn't care too much about the actual individual merits of the art, but they did care about the fact that a new generation was having the opportunity to study art regardless of their social class. Previously, if you wanted to study art, you had to be pretty well off, pretty affluent. That's why if you actually look at most of the stories of the artists, unless they're penniless and living in penury like Vincent van Gogh, etc., they were people who primarily came from the middle and upper middle classes, and the upper classes from that point of view. They were commissioned. They were patronised by various wealthy citizens in society. And in the 60s, you see a political, social, policy agenda that results in a movement that we now refer to as pop art. And this is at the heart, in many ways, of the whole huge success of the graphic narrative, the comic book. People like Stan Lee, Jack Kirby, Steve Ditko, Steranko, from the American perspective, really opening up the whole opportunities that popular culture will provide from that perspective. And so in the 1960s, you're getting this wonderful, perfect storm of fashion, art, and music, all combining to produce this brand advertising retail culture, whether it's Campbell's soup cans, whether it's silk screen prints, but it's all combining to sell a lifestyle, to create a lifestyle. Nothing new here. The Americans had actually done it previously. But again, that popular cultural image that's coming through, this is Roy Lichtenstein sort of element from that perspective, how things are going, real major happenings culturally. So from that field, you're getting the development as well of iconic pop stars. John Lennon and Paul McCartney, clearly. Eric Clapton, Peter Townsend with The Who, Ray Davies from The Kinks, Eric Burdon with The Animals, and so on and so forth. So what do we get when we start talking about this whole notion? What is pop art? Is it literally art which is popular? If you look at the Beatles' Magical Mystery Tour, if you look at Yellow Submarine and see the sort of variations that come within that, you certainly get a whole range of aspects that kind of are undoubtedly popular, but are weird, they're strange. Well, according to Richard Hamilton, a critic who actually commented on the White Album, amongst others, pop art could be defined as follows. It was popular, transient, expendable, low-cost, mass-produced, young, witty, sexy, gimmicky, and glamorous. So, just again, popular, transient, expendable, low-cost, mass-produced, young, witty, sexy, gimmicky, and glamorous. So where do we actually head off to now in terms of this sort of culture, this sort of momentary hiatus where, say, we have the Summer of Love in 1967, we have the Tune In, Turn On, Drop Out, we have the phenomenon of the Beatles and so on. Well, that whole essence of pop art being very saleable, very now, very in the moment. You buy it, you throw it away again. It's emblematic of the actual period itself. It's throwaway culture. Arguably, the sort of notion that we actually would now sort of say, you can't throw away those coffee cups, they're great art and so on. However, it is still criticised. It's criticised because, yes, it's very much targeting the young, but it also fully supports affluent consumerism. And does it really have a message? Well, it depends how you look at it. You could say it's just boring, it's shallow. But then maybe that's because the people who are criticising it are in their 30s. And if you're over 30, that's it. You're finished. Because that's not part of the youth culture. The youth culture, basically, is teenage, 16, through to late 20s and so on. That's the kind of driving force. Age itself had become democratized. We'd seen this with respect to the protests in the Vietnam War. Again, bear in mind these things are happening simultaneously and concurrently. And in terms of actually looking at the art system, well, art in itself is now democratized. More young people had access to making art and designing art and producing art than ever before. In 1964, Terence Conran opened the first ever Habitat store in Fulham Road in Chelsea. And to market his own range of modern designer furniture, he effectively sort of sold everything that you needed to live in a modern designer household. Kitchen equipment, lamps and so on. His most successful product, the one that flew off the shelves quite literally, were pasta jars. P-A-S-T-A-A, jars to actually hold pasta. Why? Because again, more young people will be beginning to experiment with new continental tastes. And pasta, obviously from Italy, seen as, it's quite sort of glamorous and so on. People would criticise the music, they'd criticise the Beatles. They'd say the Beatles weren't doing anything socially relevant. We'll have a look next week at how maybe you could actually counterbalance that argument as well. They've already mentioned, as I said, that one of the criticisms was the music was shallow, it was easy to understand, and that they were just making money. Well, everybody was making money. It's a bit like the 80s in many ways, where you kind of the pursuit of money is the sort of right to everybody's line. And again, what was wrong with that? The country itself was swinging. It was affluent. Many people were having a great time chasing all the fashions. Dedicated follower of fashion, as Ray Davis and the Kinks actually once wrote. However, behind the scenes, there was some dissatisfaction. There was the case of the Vietnam War. There were a number of other issues relating to pirate radio as well, which we'll go on to consider. And yet at the same time, in terms of turning on, tuning in and dropping out, you get something like this that comes up in the heart of 1967.
Nothing is real. The Beatles. Yellow Submarine. Photography, landscapes painted with Beatle sound.
Picture yourself in a boat on a river with tangerine trees and marmalade skies.
We all live in a yellow submarine.
Beatles. The Boo.
I must complete my bust. Two knuckles, finish my blueprints, begin my McGee.
Hey, Jeremy, must you always talk in rhyme?
If I spoke prose, you'd all find out. I don't know what I talk about.
He's a real nowhere man, sitting in his nowhere land.
The forces of evil, Robin, the butterfly stomping, snapping turtle turks, the apple bonkers, the terrible flying glove, the arch villain, the blue meanie.
You could pass for the original.
We are the original.
So my message to you as you begin to head off into the gloom of Lincoln is watch out for blue meanies, and remember, all you need is love. We'll catch up with you again on Thursday. Thanks for your time, and